Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer and tape-off founder Larry Crane. But first, the music business has a whole lot to celebrate because Spotify just announced that it's up to 28 million paid subscribers. Now, this is up from about 20 million last June, so in 6 months it added 8 million subscribers. Why is that a big deal? The more paying subscribers to streaming music, the larger the pot is for musicians, artists, bands, songwriters, record labels, publishers, everybody in the music business. Ideally, the goal is about 100 million paid subscribers worldwide. And the idea behind it is that many would offset the number of downloads and the number of CD sales that are being lost every year. So we're not quite to that point yet, but 28 million just from Spotify alone is a big step in the right direction. Now, one of the reasons why this is happening is Spotify was pretty smart, and they instituted a $5 a month, I guess it's $4.95, subscription just for students. And first of all, this is not that much money, so every student can afford it, and it also gets them in the mindset of paying for streaming music, mindset for paying for music, and it also shows them just how effective streaming music can be, a paid service for streaming music. So this is a pretty good idea, also from the standpoint that many industry pundits and experts have said for a long time that $5 a month is about the right price. We've talked about that here many times. $5 a month for streaming is the right price for most consumers. When you get beyond that, there is some price sensitivity. So $9.95 is never a good idea. Mostly it's there because the major record labels insist of that price point. But really, if all the services were around $5, that would expand the number of paying customers significantly. Another thing that's kind of interesting is the fact that Apple Music just announces up to 11 million paid subscribers. So between Apple Music and between Spotify, we're almost at 40 million paid subscribers. That's 40 million out of the 100 million. So it's moving in the right direction. Like I say, pretty soon there's going to be a lot more money for everybody involved in the music business. One of the interesting things about this is the fact that streaming music has killed piracy dead. You never hear or read about anything that has to do with piracy for the most part. That's because there's no real reason to do it. When there's so much music at your fingertips, why steal it when you can have it for free or for very little money without the hassle? So piracy is kind of dead in the water now, thankfully. Another thing that happened this week that was somewhat significant was the fact that YouTube bought Bandpage. Now, what is Bandpage? Bandpage allows you to set up an online store on most social sites, social media sites, and it allows you to monetize your online presence. Now, what was interesting about this was it was bought by YouTube for $8 million, but the investors in Bandpage had put in about $24 million, so it was bought at a bargain. What happened was, originally when Bandpage came out, in 2009, I think, it was there to build a custom tab on your Facebook page. So in other words, what would happen is you would have this tab that would allow you to sell merch on your Facebook page. The problem was in 2012, Facebook shut all of those apps down. And as a result, Bandpage went from being very successful to having no customers almost overnight. So they basically pivoted, and instead of going after just Facebook, they went after all social media sites, which kind of worked, and they have a lot of major clients, but the fact of the matter is that they were sold for a bargain price, which kind of means that they weren't making that much money to begin with. But anyway, if you're a Bandpage customer, know that things are going to change now that YouTube is in control. If you're not a Bandpage customer, it's worth checking out because it is a cool app. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I just launched a new mini coaching program, and it's called Lead and Background Vocal Mixing Tricks, as well as a live mixing workshop where I'll personally help you with your mixes. You can go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more, bobbyosinskicourses.com. More good news for musicians is the fact that it's getting easier to carry your instruments on a plane. Now, up until recently, and actually the end of last year, what would happen is if you came to the airport with your gig bag, the airlines did not have to let it on the aircraft and many times would make you check it as baggage, which obviously we know is not a good idea for a stringed instrument, especially a very expensive one. That all changed with the new law that basically says that if you arrive at the airport with a gig bag with an instrument, the airline has to let you on the aircraft with it as long as it fits in the overhead bin. And that's the real key. It has to fit in the overhead bin. The other alternative is now you can actually pay for a seat for your instrument if you care that much about it that you're willing to pay for it. Once again, you could try to do this prior to the end of last year, but the airline didn't necessarily have to sell you that ticket. Now they do. So this is really good news for people that are traveling with their instruments. One note of caution, however, the airline doesn't give you priority just because you have a musical instrument. So if you're in boarding group number 5, you get on the plane and there's no more baggage space, you're kind of stuck. What that means is it behooves you to get into an earlier boarding group, even if that means buying a priority ticket or buying priority boarding, which costs you a little bit more money, but it's worth it if you can make sure that your instrument gets on the flight with you. My guest today is a great engineer and one of the founders of Tape Op magazine, Larry Crane. Tape Op is one of the most beloved magazines in the industry, but Larry has some pretty significant engineering credits that include Elliott Smith, Sleater Kinney, Death Cab for Cutie, and The Semmerists, among others. I spoke with Larry from his home in Portland via Skype. Portland is such a great music scene.
Yeah.
And you've been a big part of it for a long time. Did you grow up in Portland?
No, I grew up in Northern California, actually. And I was born in Berkeley and raised in Oakland for a while when I was a little kid. And then I grew up near Nevada City in that area. And then I went to college in Chico, California. And that's kind of where I started playing in bands and stuff. But then when I turned 30, I moved here. The band I was in broke up and I moved up to Portland, Oregon to get out of the music world.
Get out of the music world?
I wanted to get out of the music world.
Were you engineering by that point?
No, not at all, actually. I mean, I've always recorded, you know, like in the early, like in 81, I was like part of that home cassette movement, you know, of trading tapes and stuff, making weird music at home. Like when I was in high school still. Yeah. I always had, like when a 4-track cassettes came out, my friends and my family pitched in money and bought me one, because they knew I was really into that.
Yeah.
And so I was always recording people on that and recording my own band, like demos and stuff. And I never thought about it as something as a career at all. It just was something that sort of fell together.
How did it happen as a career?
Well, I moved into a house and it had a big basement and I started building a room in there just to rehearse in. And then someone dropped off some 4-track reel to reels that their uncle had given them, a musician I was working with. It's like, hey, you want to borrow these? And I started recording stuff on that, and people would come by like, hey, can you record this for me? And pretty soon I had bought an 8-track reel to reel just to do stuff. And it started just turning into more people coming over, you know, there was a demand, you know, I had to learn it all. Like, you know, in my early 30s, I didn't know how to set a mic level.
Yeah. But how did you do that? Did you have a mentor or was it just like a mad dash to find out as much as you can?
A little of both. I mean, when I was in the band I was in was called the Vomit Launch, actually, in the 80s and early 90s. And when I was doing that, we made 4 records. And the first 2 we made with a guy named Greg Freeman, who had been in a band called Pell Mell and also was the bass player for The Call way back.
Yeah.
And he had a simple studio, like an 8-track Atari and some pretty interesting gear. But you know, he just liked music and so I kind of would watch him work and we did a few records with him. Then we did 2 records with John Bacigalupi, who's now my partner in Tape Op. And John was an engineer producer. And so I would kind of be the liaison between the band and the producer engineer most of the time. You know, I would come in with a list of overdubs and I would map out, you know, everything. I'd make 4-track demos of our stuff with the band. And, you know, so I was always doing that stuff. I just didn't think of it as anything but a means to an end. for making music. And gosh, you know, so I kind of had watched those guys work, but I never really watched the technical end. But I knew, you know, where people put mics. I knew the process of making a record, you know, like how to do the basic tracking and then do the overdubbing. And everything all made a lot of sense to me. Multi-tracking completely made sense to me from a very young age. So it was all kind of like in front of me all the time.
You know, it's interesting. It seems like every band always has one member that takes on those duties that you did.
Mm-hmm. I was also kind of managing.
Yeah.
The band. I was booking tours. We had a P.O. box. We did mail order stuff.
Wow.
We put out our own records, you know, things like that. So I was really busy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, in the studio where someone, you know, is always doing the demos, is the liaison with the producer, the engineer, and eventually in all the interviews that I do, and probably it's the same with the ones that you do as well, you find out that that's the way people sort of get into the business. Many of them anyway.
I don't think I ever would have been. I'm really not that obsessed with recording equipment at all. Like people might think, you know, you've got this nice studio and then you're so into the equipment. You know, I want to write an end rant for the magazine where I say, like, I hate recording equipment. You know, honestly, I don't care. You know, people walk up to me and start talking about Neve numbers and I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know which ones those are. I just don't care. You know, it's just a tool.
Yeah.
You know, my mom was an artist and so I was raised around this art sort of mentality, you know, of like, get good tools and work hard, you know, and it's just, the recording equipment, I like good things and things that make the job easy and things that sound good, but you know, just really, I'm not obsessed. I don't have a lot of vintage stuff. I don't really think that's an important thing to have to do or, you know, so to me, it's just like, I use the stuff. I mean, the whole studio, I didn't want to have a studio, but I wanted to help my friends make records, you know, it's the same kind of mentality.
Okay. How did the studio come about then?
And the home studio I had got so busy that my roommates were losing their minds, you know. They'd have metal bands in the basement, you know, whatever, punk rock, people sleeping on the floors. It was a little much, you know. So I, in 1996, I started looking around for a space and I ended up hooking up with Elliot Smith because he was also looking for a space to put up a studio. And we had the same exact idea, like 16 track, 2-inch tape. You know, we wanted the same kind of thing. And so we joined forces. It was still going to be my studio, but he would work out of there with a prorated deal, you know, and just bring his gear over and have a place to work. Cause I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to keep the place 100% busy. You know, that was kind of my worry or fear, which was soon found out to not be true. But, you know, it was great. So we started, you know, we built the place together and worked on some of his projects and I'd work on my records I was making for people. And we both got really busy and that, you know, we found a nice a small commercial space that was really cheap, like $500 a month.
Is it the same space you have now?
No, they tore it down a number of years ago. I moved into my new space in 2007 and that was built custom up from the ground up by some friends of mine who own the property and stuff. So that's pretty nice to have a good landlord.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, it's nice to be able to do it from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, that's happening less and less these days.
I think we're like one of the few studios in town, you know, built to be a studio. That, you know, it's not a retrofitted building. And when you get to do that, you can work on the dimensions and ceiling height and run the electrical, like we run all of our electrical runs up in the walls and drops down to the outlet and it's all covered in conduit within the wall, you know?
Yeah.
And all the audio runs underground and pops up in the boxes there for tie lines. So it's
perfect.
It's clean.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's very, very cool. How did you decide on the gear?
It's changed over the years massively. You know, there's probably just a couple SM57s left from the original studio. Initially it was like whatever we could afford, you know, I was buying like, I had a Mackie 32x8 console and a 16 track MCI and a DAP machine, but you know, all that's gone, you know, but the DAP machine's still floating around, but that's pretty useless. You know, and it just really has been like a discovery of better equipment as time's gone by. I remember my first tube condenser mic and just being like, oh my God, that's what that sounds like. You know?
Yeah.
And at this point, you know, it's a really well-equipped studio and a lot of it's from manufacturers I've met through doing tape op, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of the boutique companies that are around these days.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. And you know what impresses me is how into it they are. And when it's not so much about money, it's very much like what we do on the musical side, where, hey, let's face it, if we want to make money, we go someplace else. We go into another industry.
I tell people that all the time, because people making boutique equipment, it's just a struggle. You know, it's some of them do okay, but they're just constantly working, and it's not like you're making millions or something, because your profit margin can only be a certain amount. And the supplies to build good stuff cost money. There's no way around it.
Yeah, yeah. But they're doing it for the love of audio. Most of them, anyway, come from a good place.
And I think so.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can get into bigger players like Avid and stuff like that, which I don't think are coming from a particularly great place these days. But
you know, the thing, like I always tell people with our magazine, the thing is that the owners run it, you know, and we've always been that way. And, you know, when you have a boutique company that's been owned by the same person for 20 years, then there's a vision and there's a stability.
Yeah.
Other companies are run differently, and that's the, you know, multi-headed beast or whatever.
Yeah, right. Beast. Well, let's talk about Tape Off for a second. Sure. How did that get started?
That same journey, like, you know, when I had the home studio, I was trying to learn stuff. I was going to the library every day, and I was reading, you know, magazines and books and taking stuff home. And I would go to the bookstore and I'd buy magazines, you know, like the Mix and EQ and Electronic Musician and everything that was out there recording. And I just felt like they weren't talking about the kind of music that my friends and I were making, you know, which would ostensibly be kind of like underground or indie or college radio type music, you know, or just more weird music, you know?
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I could start. I had been writing for years for music magazines, like real zine style stuff, just doing record reviews and interviews with artists. And I thought, there's plenty of that kind of journalism out there, but what about journalism from that approach that's writing about recording, you know, interview people that make recordings and not be all focused on the equipment end of it, but instead to look at it from a creative and artistic point of view, you know, because I didn't feel like the other magazines were looking at it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was 1996. I went Xeroxed a bunch and folded them at home.
Okay, so what was your circulation when you started?
I mean, as many as I could print in a given day.
Who?
Seriously, my ex-wife worked at Planned Parenthood, and I would go down there on the weekend when the office was empty, and I would write them like a $200 donation and then use their photocopier. Kind of crazy.
Were you charging for it, or was it free at first?
I was sending a lot of free ones out to bands and labels and studios I knew about. And then was putting it on sale at Target and bookstores around town, like Powell's Books here in Portland and places like that. Super Digital is like a, you know, recording equipment store. I put a little box on the counter and sold them direct there. So, you know, I kind of just got them around. I've always been good at figuring out how to network and you know, how to promote things. Like from running, it comes from running like an indie rock label way back, you know?
Yeah.
Like you made 1,000 albums, you send out 500 promos, you know, to radio and magazines, you know, you don't just sit on them.
Well, you know, it's the same thing for me. When I first started writing books, it was coming from a place of, I wanted to learn something.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
I figured that the best way, and really it was, if I want to learn this, I think there's a bunch of other people that do as well. And that proved to be the case, much like,
I mean, I think even, you know, through the magazine, I've learned a lot, you know, it's 20 years old this year, this spring.
Really?
But I've learned a lot, and I've got to interview people, and I'd walk away and go, oh, wow. Okay. That's a concept, you know, of some kind of technique or just whatever, how to produce people. You know, you hear those stories.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You learn a lot and I find that it really helped me grow as an engineer and a producer.
No, I can understand, definitely. Who was the best interview?
I think the most significant to me was getting to interview Brian Eno. Because I've been kind of like this goal ever since I'd started, like I'll never be able to do this, but I want to talk to Brian Eno. And in going and visiting him at his studio in Portobello and just hanging out, you know, I was like, oh, this is amazing. You know, here I am. But a lot of other people have been really fascinating, you know, like David Byrne was really fun to talk to, and T-Bone Burnett, you know, really, really interesting and wise. Jim Dickinson, I didn't actually even do the interview for our magazine, but hanging out with him on and later at our Tape Op Con events and stuff, he was a real, he'd say funny things and it would just, I'd be like, that's a crazy comment. And then 2 years later, I'd be like, I get it. I get what he said. So, you know, it was really, it's those kind of things are really amazing, you know, meeting people like that and learning from them.
Were there any that disappointed you? And you don't have to name names, but just out of curiosity.
Sometimes people who make great records are not very articulate. You know, I had one recently and I love the guy, but it just didn't really, the interview was really hard to edit. Actually, I finished that one. There's been interviews I just thrown away because I look at it and I go, this is just a jumbled mess of incomplete sentences and half thoughts, and it doesn't really portray the person behind it, you know?
One of the things I learned when I first started doing interviews, and I did maybe 500 before I started to write a book, because I was writing for all the magazines, right? And one of the things I learned was people want you to translate what they're saying. They don't want you to take it literally. Because the one time I did that, the feedback I got when I sent it for approval was, hey, you make me sound like a truck driver. And I was like, well, that's the way you talk. I'm sorry. But I took it back and I said, well, I know what you want to say. So I just made him say that. And then he was over the moon. And I kind of realized that was, you know, something that a good writer has to do as well, but you have to be able to use their voice. So that's kind of the key, you know, it can't be you, it has to be them.
Right. I've totally felt that. Like my wife does a lot of my proofreading and helps edit the magazine with me. And she's always like, you know, she'll highlight something and put a little note, like clarify this or you know, and sometimes I'll send it back to people and go, do you want to add some sentences to this? You know?
Yeah.
You know, I think the idea is not, and this is the same that way I would think about recording music, is like the idea is not for, you know, to capture the reality of what happened during that interview, but to capture the thoughts and intent behind it, you know? Right. And I think about making a record the same way. I'm not there just to document the notes they're playing and everything. I'm there to help turn it into something people want to listen to.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, you have all those mentors, really, when all those interviews, all those people become mentors, which is what I've always found. Just like you were saying, you pick up something from everybody, and sooner or later, that comes into play. You're in the studio, and you go, oh, yeah, okay, remember that.
Oh, yeah. I think about, you know, talking to Tony Visconti, for instance, or something. You think about just even his demeanor when you're interviewing him makes you think that guy could be in charge of a session very gently and sternly at the same time, you know? And so I think about those sort of things, like how do I present myself at a session to get the job done, you know, and do it right, but not be overbearing or too stern, you know? And it's interesting that a lot of the really great producers have some sort of temperament and thing that they carry with them all the time that helps them take charge of a session without anyone being upset.
Yeah, right. Getting them to do what you want them to do, but making them think it's their idea.
Absolutely. You know? It's kind of, you know, guiding that gentle hand that's very, very stern.
Where do you see Tape Op going?
Well, 20 years, let's see. I mean, I kind of like more of the same, you know, just always more people to interview. There's always younger people popping up that are fascinating. I really, you know, strive for more, wider breadth of coverage, you know, it's easy for a magazine like this to fall into the, like, look at all the white males, you know,
yeah, right.
category. So anything that's kind of like breaking that mold is always nice. And then, but it's hard, you know, sometimes it's hard to find like, you know, great women producers and engineers or such. There's less, you know?
Yeah.
And
right.
You know, keep your eyes open for people that are coming from completely different backgrounds. Maybe people that are, you know, I find a real interesting thing lately is like people who are coming from a very electronic and sample based style of music that are starting to work with full bands and musicians, you know, and you know, like Flying Lotus would be a really good example, or a Danger Mouse even, you know, a few years back or something. And I think that's like Mark
Ronson.
Mark Ronson, right? See, that's a great example of someone coming from loop and DJ culture and working with full bands and things, and to, as part of that, you know, morphing it into something else too. I think that's really cool, and it's really good to keep your eyes open to that. The thing I hate is, like, we used to have this happen when we used to do the tape op cons, and there'd be a panel of producer engineers, and by the end of the panel, they're all, yeah, you know, recording a band live to 16 track 2-inch is just the way to do it. And you're like, for some records, I mean, a jazz record or something, awesome, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, show me one Stones record that was even made that way, you know, like just live to tape, you know, like it's just, it's this really frustrating, like, you know, attitude of like, there's an honest way to make records and stuff. And I really like smashing that down and throwing that out the window, because people, I've been formulating this thought, but I think there's a tendency for a lot of producer or engineers to, especially just people that think of themselves as engineers, to be really, really lazy and want to put it all back in the artist's hands and blame artists for not being good enough musicians, or, you know, they don't want to sit and do 100 overdubs to get a great vocal tape or take or something. And I think it's just fear and laziness and not willing to voice an opinion and really commit. And, you know, when you hear people talk about this, like, you know, well, just the band should be ready and they should come in and they should knock it out and it should be perfect. And it's like, you're just a lazy, stupid engineer then, if you're telling me that, because I know the reality of making records day in, day out,
yeah,
is that rarely happens. You know,
funny you should mention, I have a very good friend who's won lots of Grammys, who was telling me about working with a very famous artist who's on television a lot. So I'm just going to leave it at that. And they're making a new record, and they came into his studio, and the whole band is playing live, and because that's the way he wanted it,
yeah,
which is no problem. But the fact of the matter was, he said, they come in, they have no idea. They've never heard the song. And they put it together in a day. And he says, for the first 5 hours, it's such chaos. And then all of a sudden it comes together. And he said, you know, I haven't worked this hard in 20 years. But he was loving every minute of it, because, you know, again, everybody was coming from the same place, except for the artist who knew what the song was because he wrote it. But the rest of the band was coming from a place where, well, okay, let's just figure this out. You know, that's pretty awesome, though.
Those are fun days. I mean, you're on your toes, you know. And you're having to work really hard, but it's like when someone allows that process to be the process and works with it the right way, it's super fun, but it's hard work. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, it's just like in Nashville, all those guys that they do the big tracking sessions where they have 9 people and they do the same thing. They come in, they don't know the song. They listen to it. They write it out. Boom, done. Songs in 3 hours, you know, and they're all great.
Yeah, good players. They know how to play to the studio and play to the song, you know.
No kidding. So one of the things I noticed is most of the reviews in Tape Op are fairly positive.
Yeah.
How do you deal with negative ones?
We don't run them. Yeah. I mean, we try to get a little bit of criticism in there to make a valid point here and there. But if something's so bad, a piece of equipment is so bad that, you know, that there's just not much good to say about it, we kind of just shuttle it off and just tell the reviewer, like, forget about it. Then it'll die its own death, that product, you know?
Yeah.
You know, we, one of the reasons I started the magazine in that way was that I said, the review section to me is this, it's like you and me meeting after work in the studio all day, we're meeting for a beer. And you're like, got any good stuff lately to work with? Any good tools? I got this mic. It's pretty cool. I like it on snare. Yeah, that's my review section. That's how I want. That's what I told Andy Hong, the reviews editor. I said, this is how I want you to present it. I want these used on real sessions. I want them used in commercial studios or under pressure, you know. And I want, you know, honest reports about the stuff. And I'm not interested in somebody just being like, you know, this $99 mic is no U47, you know, it's like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
You know, judge the equipment at the price point and the intent of the manufacturer. So some reviews might be of a cheap, like ART thing that, you know, is very affordable, and you don't try to say it's not a 1176. You just say it's this other kind of compressor. It works pretty well for the price point.
Yeah.
I mean, people have accused us of, like, you know, sucking up to manufacturers and stuff. And honestly, most of the time that they try to point something out, it'll be someone who doesn't advertise with us. or something, you know, or used to, or doesn't, or now, or currently, or, you know, it's kind of like, well, how are we sucking up to someone when they're not even giving us money, you know? And that's been a frequent accusation, you know. I think if you look at our reviews and you read them, like with the idea that they're the way I presented that, you know, hanging out, having a beer, you know, that it makes more sense, you know, it's just peer to peer, you know, I use this, it works, you know.
I don't think you gain anything by trashing something.
You know, it doesn't make any sense. I once wrote a review of a really expensive pop filter that the Trans Audio Group was carrying. I think they still carry it. It's like $200, $300, yeah. $400, I don't know. It's the most expensive pop filter. And I put it up against, you know, like a Stedman or something, like just the pressed metal one. And I just went back and forth and I was like, really, it isn't any different. I'm happy with the $25 metal one. And Brad said, do you have to even run this? I mean, this is for a certain kind of audience. This is for someone who wants to just go over the top with their pop filter and spend all this money. I'm like, great, then we won't run the review.
Yeah.
And he's like, great, I'm happy.
Yeah. I used to write speaker reviews for EQ.
Yeah.
I did it for 5 years. And for the most part, we were told you can be negative, but you have to be able to you have to be negative in between the lines, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, that was okay. I felt good about that because I, you know, if people are watching and paying attention, they can figure it out. But it's not that I would be intentionally negative. Most of the time, I would just send the unit back and say, when you get a new model, let me know. And I'll do it, you know, when you get an upgrade. Or even, you know, just call them and say, hey, am I hearing this right? Am I doing something wrong? You know, at least give them a chance. But there's only one product that I can remember that I just said, "I this is terrible. I can't run this." And it was a speaker that came and gone in a flash. So I'm happy that I never actually did anything on it. But boy, you know, I was conflicted. It's like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But on the other hand, you have a responsibility to your readers.
Yeah. I think when something is really hyped and you find that it's not really a great product, it usually kind of dies off fast, you know, like I said earlier. So it's just kind of like you can ignore it for a year or two and then the company goes away, you know?
Yeah, right.
The thing I do like to do is to try to point out products that are really great, that are not getting a lot of marketing and are made, you know, the person maybe just makes a great product but doesn't have any sense of like even how to get ads out there maybe or something.
Yeah.
So I try to find those kind of products too and say, hey, look, this is really good. You know, like don't ignore it. And they might not keep making these for years too.
Yeah, right. I want to talk about lynda.com. You and I both do videos for Lynda.
Yeah.
And Lynda has been terrific for me. I really enjoyed the experience with the people, with the process, with everything. What's your feeling on it?
Same thing. I mean, it might sound like we drank some Kool-Aid or something, my experience, I really enjoy working with all the people there. Everyone's really nice and positive. Like going to the campus is amazing because meeting all these different people in different fields and they're all like really smiling and enthusiastic about their work. And you're kind of like, wow, this is a good place to work.
Yeah, right. It's very upbeat.
Yeah, it's really cool. And I love having the opportunity. I was going to hire a camera crew and shoot the kind of videos I ended up doing just to give away, just to kind of promote my studio or myself, and to be able to do the same thing and have a professional crew work on and film and edit and direct you and everything. And then to have it, you know, to earn royalties on it when people view it and stuff is just beyond my wildest dreams, honestly. You know, it's nice to have a little extra income. And it brings me work. I mean, I get people that watch the videos and then they email me and go, can you mix my record? You know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. They see that you got a good bedside manner and positive, you're a positive person and you got a lot of tricks up your sleeve and then I get work from it. So that's kind of, I never thought that was going to happen.
Yeah, that's very cool. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Really? How many courses have you done?
I have a mixing course and a recording course. And then I have the weekly course. That's going on right now, the weekly audio tip thing. And then that might morph into something else. I've been throwing ideas around, but we'll see which ones stick.
Yeah.
They're fun. They're pretty intense. The first two courses I did were shot in about 10 days. up here at my studio. And that was just like every day, go, 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 you know, it was a lot of work.
Yeah. I remember them telling me that, you know, what they're doing, because I was in the middle of post-production on something when they were getting ready to pull the recording team out and go up and see you.
Yeah, it was fun.
I want to talk about your recording workshops. So yeah. I took notice that you're doing these workshops. Tell me about them.
You know, people used to ask like if they could sit in on sessions or, you know, or intern or, and I really, because my studio is really open for freelancers and stuff, it's really hard to have interns around, you know, you can have an assistant, you know, which we have one available to hire, you know, who knows the place really, really well. But having an intern that was just kind of there as a, to move things around or something, it just doesn't feasible. And, you know, and people would always kind of ask me to, you know, go to schools and talk and things like that. But a lot of times it doesn't pay real well, you know. And I went and talked to a school here in town that was kind of a private arts college or something. And, you know, they were like, well, you only have a bachelor's degree. and they would, you know, you'd be on some kind of teacher's income, which is pretty, pretty pitiful. And I thought, wait a minute, why don't I just host things like one weekend? I can make more money than working in that place for 3 weeks, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I started doing these workshops, like 10 students max. They bring in the way the format now, it's had different formats, but I've kind of settled on one that works really good for home recordists or people that have built small little studios or whatever they're doing. And people bring in like one or two songs that they've mixed, tracked and mixed. And then we listen to the mix and I just talk, go right from that. I talk, you break it down and criticize it in a very gentle way. Yeah. You know, the whole class will listen and I'll be like, did anyone notice this? And everyone's like, oh yeah. Oh, that's kind of problematic, you know? And then we'll listen to the multi-tracks or the Pro Tools session and we'll isolate, you know, like problematic tracking techniques and mixing techniques that are out of hand or, you know, why are you putting every single plug-in is on a preset, you know, things like that, you know, the things that people kind of fall into that they don't know, you know, because all these people are like the same way I learned kind of on my own. They're learning on their own and they're making very, you know, pretty big mistakes or they're trying to tackle something like parallel compression without understanding really how to do it. Or they read something in tape op and they misappropriate the information and misapply the information,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's fun to take them and just, I mean, and when I first started doing it, I thought, how could I know so much more than other people? But when I started doing it, it's real easy. Even if someone has a pretty good mix, to just look for the things that need help and to talk and then show that this is a good example of how to track drums at home or, you know.
Yeah.
So it's pretty informative. It's really fun. It's a really great environment. People end up trading emails and keeping in touch and stuff too.
Is it for one day?
2 days. I do a weekend thing. I also do like a one-on-one version of that where someone comes for just a single day and I just go through like, you know, maybe 3 songs of theirs and we really pick them apart and I'll go run in the live room and I'll show them miking techniques and stuff, you know? And I love doing it because it's a little bit routine, you know, kind of ends up, it's like those shows where they fix bars and hotels and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, those reality shows, it kind of ends up being a little bit of a formula to it, but you know, people, when they see that stuff applied to their work, it really resonates. Like everybody leaves and goes home and sends me emails and say, everything's sounding better now, you know, just cause they've learned how to mic things and how to mix things a little bit better.
Yeah.
On their material, you know?
Yeah. So yeah. It makes a big difference. The personal touch.
Yeah. I think you could read about someone, you could see my video or something. I'd show you the same thing, but if I'm showing on their music, it really resonates, you know.
One of the things I noticed is when you write something or if you read something, many times you don't get the full picture. You get a piece of it and maybe a big piece of it, but sometimes you'll miss the little thing that really makes the big difference on the technique.
Yeah.
And
oh yeah.
And that's the thing that, you know, it's very easy to point out if it's one-on-one.
Yeah, I think so. You know, because then they'll be like, well, wait, where were you putting the mic on the stair again? You know, and they'll look at it from multiple angles and it'll make more sense.
I just saw one of those things. I love the Glyn Johns drum miking technique, but it never quite sounded the way I thought it should. And then I ran across a video of Glyn in a school. And he's walking around.
I think that's from Cuyahoga Community College.
He says the little, you know, one thing that makes it worth it. And he says, oh, yeah, you have to set the preamps about 10 dB hotter than you normally would, or else it's not going to sound good. Bing. It's like, oh, okay. And sure enough, I went back and I did that, and wow, it came alive. It was great.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of push it.
Yeah.
Just push. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense, too.
But again, you know, you read that about that technique, and I've used it for years, and it's good, but I don't think it's what, you know, they were getting back then. That's why.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
What scares you about the music business?
I don't like that it is a speculative business. You know, I get that it is. It probably has to be that people speculate on artists and careers, but I don't appreciate that everything is run in that manner. And it's a very high failure rate if you look at things from a commercial standpoint.
Yeah.
And I think that I see music as art, obviously. And, you know, even the most unappreciated album might be something that 20 years from now somebody digs up and heralds as a really breakthrough, undiscovered thing. And it's just hard to have people say that something's a failure or, you know, that album came out. Well, you know, I was thinking about Tusk the other day, Fleetwood Mac, and they always call it like, you know, the big failure, but it sold like 20 million copies or something. I don't know,
yeah, right.
You know, but it didn't sell 40, you know, yeah. million or like Dream, Groomers, you know?
Yeah. When I go and I give, you know, talks at schools, I always put up a slide and it's a magician's wand.
Yeah.
And I put magic. And the thing about it is, when you have a hit, you capture lightning in a bottle for that split second.
Yeah.
And even if you don't like the song or you don't like the artist, you have to appreciate the fact that they caught lightning there. They caught that lightning in the bottle. There's something that millions of people really dig. So
right. If
nothing else, you have to respect that fact. Even if you don't like it, you can at least respect it and learn from it. So I try to impress that on, you know, people I talk to, young people, and hopefully they'll be at least more open to listening to things.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing in our field is to be really listen to a lot of styles of music too, and understand, even if you don't like something, listen to the classic records in that genre and figure out why they work and why people like them. And I'm amazed how many times I know more about music or even the music my clients like than they do. You know, like I know more history. I'll be like, well, have you heard their first album? And they're like, what? You know?
Yeah.
And it's like, that's your favorite band. You never even heard all their records. It's crazy. So that, I think having that breadth of knowledge is really important to be able to understand how to get sounds or to produce or how to conceive of stuff. And I find that, you know, I don't know how someone could get to where I'm at in my 50s, you know, from zero to 50 or whatever. But, you know, it's also like just kind of amazing to me when people just don't have they haven't listened to a lot of music or as much as maybe they should have to get to be where they're at. And I find myself kind of giving them a list of records to go check out, you know, sometimes after.
Yeah, I hear you. Okay. Last question.
Yeah.
What's the best piece of business advice that you ever learned along the way or someone imparted to you?
I'd say the best thing I've definitely learned myself is don't approach like a recording studio as like a build it and they will come kind of thing. And don't like, I get emails all the time from people that are like, we've just spent, you know, $400,000 building this studio, write about it. And I'm like, I don't care. It hasn't made any records. Right.
Yeah. Right.
Like no one's recorded there. It's a room full of gear, like big deal. So you go to Vintage King and see the same stuff, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm not going to write about Vintage King because it's not a studio, you know? And so it's like, I think that, you know, there's a misunderstanding that the equipment drives the business. You know, it used to be, there used to be a lockdown. Like if you had a 2-inch 24 track and you were one of five people in Portland that did, you got business, right?
Yeah. Right.
There was a way to corner the market. But that's gone, and that's fine. I think that's really healthy that's gone. But it's also like, you know, you have to, if you're presenting a commercial studio, you have to up your game now as well. You, instead of being able to lock it down with a 24 track tape deck, you got to lock it down with a Neve console and a tube mic and a, you know, things that people can't afford to own at home.
Yeah. Right.
And things that make great records. You know, you're also, the gear comes after the work, you know, like having albums out that people are actually buying and listening to and care about is the only calling card that matters for a commercial studio or a producer or whoever.
Yeah. I mean, there's no business plan involved. A lot of times it's just gear acquisition only, without the thought of what to do afterwards.
I went and visited a studio that's being built in town here, and it looks really great and everything, but there are some things that I was like, oh, I don't know if I would have done this way, you know, and it was definitely being built by a guy who's a musician and not as much a recording engineer. And, you know, you kind of, depending where you're coming from, you probably take the priorities in a different way. But I think of this like when I used to be a waiter and wait tables. Like, it's a service industry and you have to think about the client all the time. You know, people come into my studio and on the back of the producer's desk is a USB charging port and a bunch of power strip charge things. Because what is the first thing they got to do? But plug in stuff to charge and their phones and their computers. And there's a quarter inch stereo jack input, so you can plug, you know, things into our monitors from back there.
Excellent.
And listen. These are very practical things that everyone needs, but half the time I go to a studio, none of that's in place. You know, so I look at it like we don't have a person sitting at a front desk. We don't have, you know, it's a very low budget studio, but the artist needs are all taken care of. There's things there that they need. There's extra charging cables for all the different kinds of iPhones and stuff. You know, everything's all there. There's filtered water and there's coffee and there's a fridge and there's all the stuff that you need. And so many times I go to a studio, you can't even get water,
right.
Yankee Studio. It's crazy.
Well, this has been cool. Thanks for spending time with me today, Larry. This is great.
Yeah. Man, thank you.
It's always fun. Always fun to talk to you. And I hope we can do this more often, actually.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Bobby.
To find out more about Larry, go to larrycrane.com. That's larry-crane.com. larry-crane.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. We love your comments and we love your questions. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. And he also put the show together. Many, 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 many thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and now Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.